Can you imagine in the midst of a sermon if someone in the congregation suddenly stood up and called out to the preacher to make a judgment on an issue in their lives? It would seem so out of place, wouldn't it? Couldn't it wait at least until later, until afterwards? Does it need to be asked? Is it the right place for such a question? And really, when we read Luke chapter 12, those sorts of thoughts should be coming into our minds as we're reading about hypocrisy, the danger of hypocrisy, and the need to be a people who fear God, who are in reverential awe of our Creator and our Saviour, rather than being in fear of men, knowing that God cares for us and provides for us and will be our helper in our time of need. And then suddenly to be accosted by this cry, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide inheritance with me." It is so out of place, isn't it? I mean, has he been listening at all? Well, you know the answer to that question, don't you? Nope. He hasn't been listening. I mean, he's been there, in the middle of the crowd. This is where the voice cries from. Someone in the crowd said to him, the crowd that has been amassing around Jesus and listening to all that he's been saying, and this man's been among them, but his mind hasn't been on what Jesus has been saying. His mind's been elsewhere. His mind's been thinking about that inheritance that apparently his brother is refusing to share with him. Justly or unjustly, we're not told. But the point is that he's not been paying attention to what Jesus has been saying. He's been taken up with his own thoughts, with his own problems. And it presents to us a very real problem here this morning. The problem of inattention. Now, it's not the main point of this passage, I'll acknowledge that. But I do like the fact that a couple of commentators draw out this lesson. That, you know, we can be sitting here and listening to the preaching and reading of the Word of God, and we're not taking in a single word. We can come to the end of the sermon and thank the preacher very much for the sermon, and hope that they don't ask, "What part of the sermon did you like best? What was most helpful for you?" And you're scratching your head and trying to think, what was he even talking about? I don't know. Wasn't really listening. And that's a real problem, not just for you children, though I acknowledge sometimes there are far more distractions for you, and your mind struggle to keep up with some of the hard words and phrases that I use. But for the adults too, this is a real danger. Inattention. Not really listening. The words are going in one ear and out the other, and there's just this vague vacuum in between the two. And it's not registering. It's not being taken in. It's not being processed by your brain. So, well, I guess that's a good way to start a sermon, isn't it? Have I got your attention now? As I said, that's not actually the main part, the main point of this passage. What then is the main point of the passage? Well, I hope just in the reading of the word earlier, and perhaps through the fact that each of the hymns and the psalms and the songs that have been chosen, and the Old Testament reading also, they've all been around this theme of possessions and wealth and how we are to view them, how we are to handle them in our lives. And the title of the message this morning, The Danger of Covetousness, comes out of this passage where Jesus says, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness. Some Bibles translate that as all greed. The danger of covetousness. So here's this man, he's in the crowd, his mind is totally taken up with the fact that his brother isn't dividing the will with him. We don't know the reasons. Was the brother the firstborn and therefore legally entitled to the bulk of, if not the whole of, the parents' wealth? And this older brother, this firstborn, is refusing to divide the inheritance with his younger sibling. Or maybe it's that they've been given some instruction, some guidance as to how the inheritance is being divided, and this particular brother is refusing to comply with those instructions. Whatever it is, this man has been taken up with this, and that's what he's obsessed with, and he suddenly cries out in the midst of the crowd asking for this rabbi to give his judgment on the situation. Now, that in and of itself wasn't uncommon, apparently. In family matters, people would often go to the rabbis and seek not only their advice, but their judgment on a situation, because they were people of standing, they were people who were respected, they were people of authority. And so this question, while it's totally inappropriate in the context, isn't unusual of someone asking a teacher to give their judgment on a situation, on a problem. Jesus, however, has not come into this world to be a judge and an arbiter between brothers. He's come into the world to seek and to save the lost. And what this man is demonstrating in raising the question in this particular way is that he is lost. He is lost. He's lost not because he's lost out on the inheritance that his brother is grasping. He is lost because his whole focus is in totally the wrong place. He's not listening to the word of God. He's not feeding upon the very life of God. His whole world is taken up with material things. And he's missed the point of all that Jesus has been saying here. Whom should he fear? He should fear God. He will have to give an account to God for the way that he's lived his life. And it's just not registered with him. He's taken up with the desire to have this wealth or a portion of this wealth. And so Jesus warns him, warns them. Perhaps he's speaking to the man and his brother. Perhaps this man dragged his brother along as well as he came to the teacher. And so when Jesus said to them, perhaps it's to both of them that he's saying, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of your possessions. Now go and sort it out. Or more likely, he's turning to the crowd. And he's taking this as an opportunity to teach this vast multitude who are pressing around him, so many that they're beginning to trample one another. And he says to them, take care. Be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life doesn't consist in the abundance of his possessions. And so we can know that he is saying to us, here today, 2,000 years removed and half a world away from where Jesus spoke these words, he is yet speaking to us, and he's saying to us, take care. Be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Then Jesus gives this story, this parable that is well known to us all, the parable of the rich fool, as we call it. A land of a rich man produced plentifully. He had so much that he had nowhere to store his crops. And so he's thinking to himself, he's pondering this dilemma, what am I going to do? And suddenly, in the shower one morning, he has a brainwave. I'll tear down my old barns, I'll build bigger, better barns that will accommodate all of these crops, all of my possessions. I'll be able to store them all up for myself. And I'll say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. He could afford to, couldn't he, with such an abundance. But God says to him, fool, you are not wise, you are a fool. This night your soul is required of you, and these things you've prepared for yourself, for your comfort, for your pleasure, whose will they be then? Jesus says to the crowd, so is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Notice firstly a challenging diagnosis. There's a problem. There's a problem. The problem is covetousness. Jesus tells this story having said, be on your guard against all covetousness. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about covetousness. He's talking about greed. He's talking about the longing, the yearning for more, for better. Now, the problem here is not wealth in and of itself. This man, this rich man with an abundance of crops, is not criticized for being wealthy. Okay, that's not the problem. Abraham was wealthy. He was the friend of God. Job was wealthy. He lost it all, admittedly, but you know, when God restored him to health, he doubled his wealth. He had twice as much at the end of the book of Job as he had at the beginning, and what he had at the beginning was an enormous amount. He was wealthy. Solomon was wealthy beyond our imagination. None of these men are criticized for their wealth. Solomon had his problems, but it wasn't his wealth that was his problem. And so when we come to this passage, don't think to yourself, God is against wealth. He's against riches. In fact, you read through the book of Proverbs, those wise sayings, and the contrast that is often made in the book of Proverbs is between the wise and the fool, isn't it? But one of the pictures that is often given there is that the fool is likened to a sluggard who is unwilling to get out of bed and do a good day's work for a good day's pay. Whereas the wise man does. He's diligent. He's active.
He's resourceful. He's wise. And it says that he will accumulate wealth. Part of the responsibility of a wise person is to provide for himself and for his children and for his grandchildren. Wealth is not the problem. Neither is the wealth that's described in this passage one that is gained dishonestly. The Bible does talk about dishonest gain. It does talk about people who amass wealth through lies and deceit. There are examples, a couple of examples from the book of Jeremiah. In Jeremiah chapter 17 and verse 11. Like the partridge that gathers a brood that she did not hatch, so is he who gets riches, but not by justice. In the midst of his days they will leave him, and at his end he will be a fool. And chapter 22 and verse 13, woe to him who builds his house by unrighteousness, and his upper rooms by injustice, who makes his neighbour serve him for nothing, and does not give him his wages. And so it goes on. Now this man's problem in this parable isn't unjust gain. He's not being criticised. He's not being called a fool because he has amassed his wealth illegitimately through treading on other people and being dishonest in his business dealings. Now this man's wealth has come as a gift from God, hasn't it? The land of a rich man produced plentifully. Now, he wasn't a sluggard either, was he? He was a farmer. He had gone out. He had planted his seed in the fields. And this seed hadn't brought forth 30-fold or even 60-fold. It had brought forth 100-fold. That's the image that we're given here. God had blessed him with an abundant crop. So much so that when he gathered in this crop, it was more than ever he had anticipated harvesting. His barns weren't big enough for it. They'd always been big enough before. Every year up until this point, he'd been able to fit his harvest into his barns. But this year, there's such an abundance from this harvest that he decides to tear down his old barns and build bigger ones to store it all. This wealth, then, that he amasses is not a problem in and of itself, and it's not a problem because of dishonesty. The problem with this man is not his wealth, but his covetousness. It's not his wealth, but it's his greed. It's not his wealth, but rather that he has looking to his wealth for satisfaction rather than to God. That is this man's problem. Now there's a lot more that we can and will say about this, but really at the heart of this man's problem is the fact that he sees all of this wealth and it's all about him. Over and over again, he uses the first person. What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. It was all about him. He had no thought for anyone else. He had no thought for the people around him. And he had no thought for the God who had blessed him with this abundant harvest. There was no acknowledgement of God upon his lips at all. It was all I and my. And he was unwilling to think about the needs of those around him. His desire was to gather in this harvest and retain it all for himself. He wasn't going to give it. He wasn't going to share it. And that's what the compiler of the book of Proverbs talks about with regard to wealth. He writes in Proverbs chapter 14, for example, and in verse 21, "Whoever despises his neighbour is a sinner, but blessed is he who is generous to the poor." Or chapter 19 and verse 17, "Whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deed." But those thoughts don't cross this man's mind. They're not there at all. It's all about himself. To gather, to keep, rather than to give and to share. Look, he's brought in harvests before. He's filled his barns before. He's had sufficient to get him through from year to year before. He has this huge abundance this year. Why tear down perfectly good barns when there are so many needy all around? He could have given it away. He could have sold it at a discount. He could have helped out the poor around him. But no, all he's interested in is himself and his own comfort, his own ease. He won't have to plant a crop next year. He won't have to harvest a crop next year. He can relax, eat, drink, be merry. He can go on a permanent party. And Jesus says, this man is a fool. He's a fool. That's the challenging diagnosis. Because Jesus is saying to this man who has just approached him and said, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." He's saying to this man, "Are you a fool?" He's saying to the crowd all around him when he says to them, "Take care, be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." He's saying to them all, "Are you a fool?" And he's saying to us this morning, "Are you a fool? Are you a covetous person? Are you grasping and gathering and retaining? Are you all about you and not about God and the people around you?" What diagnosis would God give this morning with regard to you and your choices? The second thing I want you to consider is the worrying prognosis. Diagnosis, what is the problem? Prognosis, what's the outcome going to be? There's a day of reckoning, Jesus says. For this man in the parable, the day of reckoning came on the very night that he had decided to build the bigger barns and to hold his amassed wealth. God said to him, "Fool. This night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" You're not interested in anyone else. But it's not going to be for you. You're not going to be able to take this with you, are you? That's what the writer of Ecclesiastes was saying, wasn't he? In Ecclesiastes 5 that we read earlier. You can't take it with you. So if you're amassing all of this for yourself, for your own ease, for your own pleasure, and God comes to you today and says, "Today, your soul is required of you." Well, what are you going to do? How's this this thing that you've been obsessed with, these possessions that you've been amassing, how is it going to help you then? You see, our lives are not just about our lives in this world. Yes, our lives in this world are real. And yes, we have to eat, we have to drink, we have to clothe ourselves, we have to shelter our families, we have to provide. All of those things are true, but we're not talking about those things, are we? We're talking about above and beyond the bare necessities of life and what we're doing with that. This man was amassing it all for himself, but he can't take it with him. And one day he must stand before God. We're soul as well as body. There's an eternal as well as a temporal state. It's not just about caring for flesh and blood. It's about caring for our spirits, for our souls, for eternity. And if all of our focus is upon the amassing of wealth and the guaranteeing of ease and pleasure in this life, in this world, then the outcome for eternity is not looking good. What will endure beyond the grave? Nothing. Nothing at all. What is not given away will be taken away. What you're unwilling to share now can't take with you. It'll be taken from you. That's what this man is being told in this parable. Whose will they be? Well, if he has children, maybe they'll go to his children. There's no mention of family here, is it? It's all about himself. He doesn't talk about my family. At least now my children's futures are secure. He's not thinking about that. He's all about himself. So possibility is that he doesn't have family. He's lived his whole life selfishly, just about him. Where's he going to go then? Well, quite possibly it'll end up in the pockets of the very people he was trying to keep it from, as he kept it for himself. The people he was refusing to give it to freely, they would receive it in the end in God's poetic justice. God does take care of the poor. He does take care of the needy. And this man, he's losing everything in a night. His money, his grain, his dreams of bigger barns, his freedom, his soul. It's all going this night. He's a fool. And the prognosis for him is bleak. And so it is, Jesus says, so it is for the one who is laying up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. That same prognosis is to be considered by all who have been challenged by the diagnosis. If I don't change, this is where I'm going. That's what the doctor's saying. You need to treat this problem, or it's going to end up in the same way as this rich fool. So, my third point is that there is a relieving remedy. There's a remedy. Here it is. Be rich toward God. That's what Jesus says, isn't it? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. What's the remedy? To be rich towards God. In other words, this man was amassing riches for himself. He was greeding for riches for himself. It was all about himself. And Jesus says, no, it's not all about you. It's about God. It's about honouring God. How then are we to be rich towards God? Well, I suggest in these three ways. We should be rich, firstly, in acknowledging God. The acknowledgement of God. To be rich in thanks and praise of God. That thankfulness is so absent from this man in the parable, isn't it? It's all about him. What shall I do? I've nowhere to store my crops. When it was the land that had produced under God's blessing. But this man doesn't go to the temple with a tithe of his first fruits and give thanks and praise to God for all that he's done in giving this so abundant a harvest that he has the problem of where to store it. There's no mention of God because God doesn't figure in this man's life. He doesn't register in this man's mind. He has no place in this man's heart. And so there is no praise for God. And we must at least begin there, in the acknowledgement of God. That God is in control, that God is sovereign in my world, in my life. So if I find myself prosperous, if I find that in my business dealings I'm doing well, I must acknowledge God. It is God who works behind all the scenes that enables us to be successful, to be profitable, to gain in wealth. And so we must begin there. To be rich in thanks and praise to God, in acknowledgement of God. The second way in which we can be rich towards God is in our contentment in God. In other words, we should be rich in trust of God. We read that godliness with contentment is great gain. And the Apostle Paul writes that he has learned to be content in every situation, whether in poverty or in wealth. And this is where we must work to find our contentment in trusting in God. Being rich in trust of God. Being able to say, whatever circumstance of life that we're in, God is in control. He is my Father. I will trust him here. I'm not going to complain about my circumstances. I'm going to pray about my circumstances because I'm trusting in God. So in the midst of the hardships that come into our lives and the problems at times of wondering how we're going to make ends meet, how we're going to pay the bills, how we're going to progress through this year, we trust in God. And when the floodgates open and the bank balance just seems to be getting bigger and bigger and we're amazed at it all, we trust in God. Trust in him, in what he expects of us in this day of prosperity, this day of wealth. Because it leads me into my third way in which we can be rich towards God, and that's in imitation of God. in imitation of God, to be rich towards the needy. This man wasn't, was he? He wasn't thinking about the needy. He wasn't thinking about the poor at all. He was only thinking about himself and his own wealth. It's not the only time when a rich man has come to Jesus and sought Jesus' advice. In fact, the man I'm thinking of was a man who was concerned about eternity. And the question he came to Jesus with was not a question about how he could ensure and guarantee his inheritance, but how he could ensure and guarantee a place in heaven. And that rich man went away from Jesus very sad, because Jesus said that he was to sell all that he had and give it to the poor. And he found that he couldn't do it. He found that it was too difficult a task to let go. You know, that man was no different from this man. He was clutching on to his wealth. He hadn't realized it until Jesus confronted him with it. But he walked away a sad man, because he couldn't let go. And as he clung to his wealth, he walked away from eternal life. The eternal life that he was conscious of and longed for, but the price was too great for him. We need to be imitators of God. And we become imitators of God when we're rich towards those who are in need. And you say, well, how is that? And I say, because Jesus Christ came into this world. And he didn't cling to equality with God, but he let go to become a servant so that he might save us in our need. So that he might bring us to God. So that he might cleanse us of all our sin and remove all our unrighteousness. So that as perfect new creatures, we could be adopted into the family of God and become joint heirs with him of all the riches of heaven. And Jesus gave up the glory of heaven and came into this sin-sick world in order to save us. He gave himself for those who were in need, and we're to imitate him. Jesus himself taught that in the upper room before his betrayal. As the disciples gather together there to celebrate the Passover, you remember the scene. Now every one of them walked past the basin of water that was set inside the door for the purpose of washing the feet of those guests who had come. Not one of the disciples was willing to humiliate themselves by taking the role of the most menial servant. But Jesus did. He divested himself of his garments, and he wrapped himself in the towel, and he took that bowl of water, and he went systematically around the disciples, washing their feet, being a slave to them. And then he said to them, as I have done for you, do for each other. Be a slave to each other. Be a servant to each other. These principles run through the teaching of the New Testament, that we're not to live for ourselves, but we are to live for him who died for us. And what does he ask us to do? He asks us to imitate him in humility, in lowliness, not to claim any rights of our own, but to give ourselves to others. So how does that apply in this particular context? Was, as I say, if we are to be rich towards God, we are to be rich towards the needy, to imitate God, to be like God, to bear the character of God as children of God. This then is the remedy to covetousness. To be rich towards God, in acknowledgement of God, in contentment in God, in imitation of God. Our focus then shouldn't be on ourselves, but upon God. Not upon life in this world now, but on eternity. To use another phrase that Jesus used, we're to lay up our treasure in heaven, not on earth. The treasure on earth, it goes mouldy, it goes rusty. Thieves break in and steal it. But the treasure in heaven is incorruptible, undefiled, and unfading. It's for eternity. We can't take anything with us out of this world. All the wealth that we amass, all the skills that we develop. And I would say here, you know, sometimes we think of coveting and greed as applying only to money. But, you know, it can apply to other things as well. It can apply to amassing skills and knowledge. It can apply to the time that we have, and clinging to time as though our time is our own, and an unwillingness to give of our time to others. We can do that as well. But God is calling us to give, to give, to give. Because we can't take anything with us out of this life. But you know what you can do? You can invest in the life to come. During this life, you can lay up treasure in heaven. And you do that by being rich towards God. May God help each one of us to do that and not be diagnosed as fools.